Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Carrie murdered a child.
The evidence and the counter-evidence, I'm struggling with that. When the facts are filled with coincidences, don't dismiss those coincidences.
I have no tolerance for the unexplainable.
Well then, sir, you'll have no tolerance for me.
Hello and welcome to the first Still Watching podcast of 2020. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
That's right. Richard's back.
Yay.
We're back together again. Thanks so much to Anthony for stepping in on The Mandalorian. But it's nice to also have you back, to talk some prestige TV with me, Richard. Which show have we decided to start out with on a cheery note, in 2020?
Well, yeah, we just wanted something light because, you know, the real world is pretty dark. So we chose, The Outsider, an HBO miniseries based on a Stephen King novel about child murder.
Yay! Happy New Year!
Yeah,
so we're here back on our HBO Sunday night, beat, to bring you this, mini series starring Ben Mendelsohn, Cynthia Erivo, briefly Jason Bateman, et cetera, et cetera. We are in this episode of the podcast, we will be covering the first two episodes, which aired, this Sunday night back to back. So you can watch both episodes. You're going to watch both of them. You're going to want to watch both of them before you listen to us talk about them, because we will be spoiling everything that happens in those first two episodes. But something we decided, you know, even though this miniseries is based on a Stephen King book that anyone listening to this can go out and read for themselves, we will not be doing a spoiler section or a book reader section or anything like that. We're just sticking to the show, sticking to these 2 hours to start out with, and there will be no book discussion, or at least like future book discussion. If the show decides to diverge wildly from the book and we feel like that's worth talking about at some point, we could talk about that. But other than that, this is a show only podcast. We love it when you guys email us because you notice a lot of things that we miss. You have a lot of great insights. So if you want to email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, that is where you can still find us. We love to hear from you. But let us start before we sort of get into the meat of what happened in these 2 hours. I wanted to start by asking you, Richard, this was sort of, you wanted to do this show or No, it was a joint decision, but like you had watched it before I had. So what was it about this show, at least in these first 2 hours that you responded to that you felt like was worth, chatting about week to week?
Well, I think it's really interesting, to bring two great genre writers together in the forms of Stephen King, who wrote the novel, and Richard Price, who wrote a lot of the initial episodes of the show and is known as like the crime guy. He did The Night Of. He wrote for The Wire, I believe. He's written some great crime novels like Clockers and the screenplay for the Spike Lee movie based on the novel. A really, really beautiful book about, kind of mid-aughts, Manhattan called Lush Life that everyone should read if they haven't. It's a mystery, but it's also just like beautiful kind of anthropology of an era. And yeah, so I thought that might be, that would be an interesting thing in combining King's sense of really, you know, oppressive dread and horror, with a guy who does really like interesting textured lived in procedural stuff, and blending those two formats together, I think, hopefully will make for, something interesting to talk about.
Yeah. And I think barring like, I don't know, 15 minutes of these first two, episodes or even less, I think there's some like creepy shots, that we can talk about, but like, you could almost think that this was, the second season of Night Of or something like that. Like this feels very Richard Price, right off the bat, you know, down to the fact that we have, you know, a suspect taken into custody, and it seems like all signs are pointing to the fact that like he didn't do it. So, it's a very Night Of premise, but yeah, to put it through the lens of Stephen King, I think that's going to be interesting for me as well. What is your history with Stephen King? Like what is your relationship? I don't know that I've ever talked to you about Stephen King. What's your relationship with Stephen King, Richard?
Oh, we don't know each other that well. Just at parties, you know.
Okay.
No, you know what? This is kind of embarrassing to say. I've never read a Stephen King novel. I think when I was younger, my sister kind of was like tearing through them one summer, and I was too scared. Like I was like, I don't want to do that. But I have seen a lot of the stuff, you know, that has been based on his books, from, you know, the kind of cheesy 90s miniseries like The Stand or Storm of the Century, which I think he might have actually just written for TV, you know, from the Pet Sematary from, you know, the early 90s, and The Shining from the 80s. Like, you know, I've seen a lot of his stuff, and I appreciate sort of where he's coming from. Although the fact that he doesn't like Kubrick's Shining and did like the cheesy Steven Weber miniseries that came many years later, gives me a little bit of pause sometimes about like his sort of taste level, maybe. But I don't know. I know people are really diehard fans of his. Are you?
I feel hit and miss on King. And something that King does really well is, explore turn certain very adult themes into genre horror without losing the like mm-hmm. seriousness and depth of that. A lot of that has to do with like, child abuse or abuse of children. And then also, trauma that we carry with us. And then also, sort of rot at the center of small towns and institutions. And I think you see a lot of that in this series, in these first two episodes. So that's something that I'll be interested for us to talk about. I'm usually more of a fan of his short fiction. I'm a big fan of a lot of Stephen King short fiction, but yeah, no, I would consider myself a King fan. The thing that I don't like that sometimes happens in King books is I think he's so good at, you know, giving us, like, say with The Shining, giving us something like, I don't know, writer's block or toxic masculinity or whatever you want to say it is, and making that into like a horrifying supernatural, thing to explore. But then when those themes become a little too literalized in the end, like, I don't know, some of the stuff that happens in It, when the confrontations mm-hmm. become too literalized, literally monsters, that's where he loses me sometimes. So, we will see how this all turns out. A big draw for me on this particular show is not just the Richard Price of it all, which you mentioned is a really big draw, but also like this crazy great cast. You and I are big Ben Mendelsohn fans. We're big Cynthia Erivo fans, even though Cynthia Erivo has yet to arrive in the show. She's coming. Jason Bateman.
I heard what you just said.
I was hoping maybe you hadn't. Anyway, Jason Bateman is not only in these first two episodes, but he directed, Emmy-winning director Jason Bateman directed these first two episodes. I know you're the world's biggest Ozark head, so you know, there's that. Bill Camp, who a lot of people know from Night Of, but also his stage work, big fan. Patty Considine, who I love, who's an Irish actor who's doing this like very large performance in the first episode. Julian Nicholson, who I'm a big fan of, who's playing Jason Bateman's wife. So it's just like, it's a great stacked cast, as you might expect from a Sunday night HBO show. So I'm excited for us to follow them.
I like that it's a packed cast, but it doesn't feel like a stunt cast, you know? Like, it feels like people are really considered for, you know, like Yul Vasquez is not a huge name, but he's a great actor and he fits into this series really well. Mayor Whittingham, you know, similarly. It's just, it has that kind of Pricean lived in texture, and these actors are really good at doing that. So it feels really credible and like a, you know, gloomier version of The Real World, which is what kind of makes it, I think, so much scarier when in episode two, we start to sense that maybe something not necessarily of the tangible world is kind of
going on.
All right,
absolutely. So let's maybe like zoom through, like what's interesting to me is, when I thought it was just this first episode that was airing on Sunday, I was a little curious as to why, because I was like, it felt like they both zoomed through a lot of stuff in the first episode, you know, like, not only is our, suspect, like, apprehended and imprisoned, but we already have a whole raft of evidence that, like, he couldn't have done it, as well. And so why are we already here at the end of the first episode? I guess I was thinking, like, well, maybe they needed you to already know that this was, like, a King-esque kind of story, but they don't really get, you know, you get like one shot, I believe, in the first episode of like a creepy looking hooded man, like sort of staring into the camera, but you don't really get into the, like, maybe there is something unexplainable going on until episode two, when you have, which is titled Roanoke, when you have certain discussions of the supernatural come into it. So I don't know, like, as a pilot of a miniseries, as like an episode supposed to pique our interest but keep us oriented in the world, what do you make of this first hour and its pace and what it wants to accomplish there?
Well, I mean, I think it is hard because you know, as we learn in episode two, like, Terry Maitland, the character played by Bateman, is really just the catalyst for the story and not who the story is about. But that first episode kind of makes it seem like it's, you know, Bill Camp and Riz Ahmed in Night Of, you know, trying to like get to the bottom of things, you know? And then I think that the second episode of this show upends that, much like, you know, killing Ned Stark in episode 9 of the first season of Game of Thrones. Like, this obviously happens much earlier. We don't really know who Terry is, which I think is kind of an interesting choice. I sort of almost think that they either needed, I mean, in a perfect world, Terry would have died at the end of the first episode as the real kind of like hooky thing, like, oh, they just killed Jason Bateman, or he's around for many more episodes. Killing him off in the second episode almost means you kind of have to show both on the premiere night, because I don't know that that first hour alone, while intriguing and well shot and well acted, it could seem like just another murder mystery, because I don't think that hooded figure shows up until episode two. Maybe I missed him in the first episode, but
he's in the first episode.
Oh, he is. Okay.
I know for certain, because like I only watched that hour, and I had him in my notes. So.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of brief. He's kind of brief, but, it's much more of a thing in the second episode for sure.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's an interesting strategy. I mean, you know, like, HBO obviously is not anytime soon going to abandon, at least on their main platform, the, you know, you know, once a week kind of format. But like, I understand giving this series, which doesn't have that high a profile, even though it's a Stephen King show. And they normally like to start January with something big. And this could be big if people get into it, but I think you needed that second hour to really sell it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I really like Bateman in this, and I like Bateman for this character too, because I think we talked about this when you and I did an episode about Ozark, is that like Bateman is a character, as a performer, is someone I always like to watch, but also someone I always inherently distrust for some reason. It doesn't matter who he's playing. I'm always like a little looking askance at that character. There's some quality to him. And so I think that's kind of perfect for this role, where you're meant to be unsure as to his guilt and innocence. And he's got this moment at the beginning of episode two where he's talking about, Ralph's kid, who passed away, who died from cancer, who he coached in Little League. And he's got this just like this long monologue about this kid. And Bateman is so good in that. And I had already like spoiled myself and read that his character gets shot really early on. And so I was like, I don't want him to go. Mm-hmm. Like, I want him to stay around. So, that's a powerful card to play, to have someone as engaging as Jason Bateman, second build, or, you know, build high up, not second build, Cynthia Erivo second build, but like build high up on a show. And then to like, yeah, Ned Stark and in episode two. So now it's just Ben and Cynthia, who is yet to arrive. So we'll see where we go from there. What do you make of these of the introduction of various characters? So we get like, let's start with the Anderson family. We get Ralph Anderson, played by Ben Mendelsohn, and his wife Jeannie, and they've lost their son. And there are ways in which I think that is well done. And then there's like just one scene where the two of them are discussing their son, and it's just a little too confused motivations. He's like, you know, I never know how much the death of our son basically is influencing the way in which I pursue criminals. But I like that theme, because it's like when he goes and he arrests Terry at the baseball game, it's personal. He's not being professional in that moment. He's letting his personal anger about the death of his own son and the fact that this is an adult figure who was in charge of his son at one point, cloud his behavior. So like this presentation of the Anderson family, this presentation of this kind of investigator, like how did that land for you, Richard?
I mean, I know what you mean, that like sometimes it was a little bit like, they were telling and not showing, you know, like the right scene that we're in there in the cemetery, and Mendelsohn just kind of says, I miss him so much. And it's like, I don't know, would people say that? But like, I think that the other kind of read of it is that, you know, this, he's investigating the death of a child. He lost a child. Something new has been stoked in him. Presumably he's not done a lot of child murder cases. I mean, you know, they haven't given us any backstory to that effect, but like, I don't think in the course of many detectives' lives, they deal with that kind of thing more than once, you know, if at all. So it makes a little more sense if you kind of think of it through that lens, as like he's speaking more directly because these are like new feelings, you know, and new realizations about like, have I been like kind of, you know, acting out my kind of rage and despair over my son's death through my work, you know? And I think that obviously he makes this huge, tactical error in, arresting Terry in front of, you know, basically this whole town or suburb or whatever it is, this whole neighborhood, you know, because he's angry and he doesn't think about how that will affect things. And in essence, that action is what gets Terry killed. Not that the brother of the murdered boy wouldn't necessarily find out that, Terry was the suspect, but he certainly, certainly it wouldn't be as public as it was. There wouldn't be all the chaos of walking him into court, you know? So I don't know. I think the interesting thing about this show thus far is that like, actions have consequences and things get remembered. And I like this kind of idea that maybe, you know, that I think sprung from King, that like, you know, a cop acting a bit bragged, you know, sort of with a bit of bravado, which is maybe rare for him, has long tethers that maybe kind of are hurtling us through this whole season.
Right. That, you know, there might be something supernatural at play, but the super, in King, I think the supernatural always reflects, a flaw, a systemic flaw or a personal flaw that's already there. You know what I mean? And so that this is a, you know, a night of miscarriage of justice, you know, that might have a supernatural explanation. But what's interesting is like the way in which this is set up, there is, it's not like Mendelsohn's character, Detective Ralph Anderson, is acting wildly recklessly. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. there is mm-hmm. just a mountain of evidence that we see stack up, against Terry. And so, you know, it puts us in a more uncomfortable gray area because it's not like he's a bad cop behaving badly. You know, and that's driven home by the fact that at one point it sort of implied that he should lose some evidence that weakens their case. Just to make sure that they can make their case, and he refuses to. And so this is not a bad guy, but the fact that the cracks in the system are more subtle, and less of a big mustache twirling villain, sort of thing. I think that makes for a more interesting television.
Yeah. And I think it's really smart how quickly we get to the arrest and you're like, wow, that was rash. And then they keep cutting back to another scene of Ralph interviewing an eyewitness.
Right.
And then they cut, you know, to the arrest, back to the arrest. And it keeps mounting. You're like, by the end of that sequence, you're like, oh, so like they've got him dead to rights. I mean, like, you know, cause you start more on Bateman's side. And then by the end, you're like, but wait, look, there's like all of that very, very strong evidence, you know?
Right.
And I just like the way that that information is meted out in the show because it really, you know, kind of tests your, or, you know, your loyalties or whatever, you know, it's an interesting kind of, view on the sort of duality of the story as it is thus far.
I want to hop over to the Maitland family, we spend more time with as well. But before we do, I want to ask you what you think of the level of or lack thereof so far of gore in this. This is something that I kind of appreciate about this because like right around this time last year, you and I were doing True Detective. And so there are things about this, you know, this sort of grim gothic murder mystery sort of thing that, you know, will make me inevitably think of True Detective. But, the way in which True Detective, sort of reveled in his grisliness sometimes, is something that at least thus far the show has kind of avoided. You get this. Go ahead.
Yeah. They do show the body quickly, you know,
yeah.
And they show his face and then his back a little bit. And then that's it.
And that's it.
You know, I think that a lot of times on shows like, you know, that are on, you know, cable where they can show stuff, they kind of do revel in that, even if it's like a kid. And I admire the show's restraint and we don't see it ever again. They're not throwing the crime scene photos at anybody and, you know, for an extra little bit of gore. It's quick. We get the impact of it and then we process that and then don't have to see it again.
Right. Which, you know, there might be more coming. This is, but I think that level of restraint, might surprise people who like maybe they think I don't have the stomach for a Stephen King show, you know what I mean? And I don't know if it sounds weird for me to be praising the show about child murder, for its restraint, but you know, it's like, it could be a lot more gruesome than it is. And, I appreciate that. Okay. So let's talk about the Maitlands. We meet Terry and, his wife Glory, played by the great Julia Nicholson and, two daughters. And, over the course of the 2 hours, we get them not only as like, this family that, you know, they lose their father, et cetera, thing. Stephen King is always interested in like children and their sensitivities to supernatural things. And so there seems to be something going on with one of the daughters in terms of like her dreams and maybe a visitation of some kind. So what do you make of the Maitlands?
Yeah.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from. whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Yeah, I mean, there's a man talking to her, which she says at night, and saying dark things and telling her things about her father. And, you know, that's always that's both a creepy device and also maybe a slightly overused one. But, you know, when it's used well, like I think it's used well here. And it made me think of the my current sort of favorite new network show of the year, or only favorite network show of the year, is Evil from Robert and Michelle King. That's like, it's interesting because it's kind of similar, where it's like, it's them applying their sort of legal procedural wit to a scary show, kind of like Richard Price is here in a way. And that show, Evil, involves partly, the lead character's daughters are frequently sort of seemingly to commune with various, you know, demonic energy or whatever. And the fear of that, the scary part of that as, you know, an adult, is that like, you sometimes just don't, you can't control every sort of thing that reaches your child, you know? And the helplessness of that, I think, is well communicated in these two episodes. I especially like the scene where, you know, Glory is obviously distraught. She's angry at the police. She's concerned for her children. She's grieving. You know, it's a lot of things for Julianne Nicholson to carry. And then her daughter is the one who remembers all of these details about this trip to Dayton, that proves, you know, that could prove really, you know, useful information about him having a cut and there being the barbecue restaurant and all that. And I think that, like, it's another sort of example of, like, you don't always know what your kids are absorbing, what they're noticing, what they're taking in. And I think those are all very much, you know, kind of primal Stephen King themes.
Yeah, absolutely. Aside from these two sort of main families that we meet, are there any of the side characters that stood out to you as particularly like worth discussing?
Well, I love Bill Camp as the kind of family lawyer who's, you know, gruff, competent, on their side firmly. I think he's great. I hope he sticks around. Yul Vasquez, who plays the lieutenant from, I think, the state police,
right,
who's kind of assisting with the investigation or leading, I don't know, but like, I think, you know, he's always good. I am kind of, at the moment, the whole stuff with Patty Considine in the bar seems a bit atomized from everything else, you know, like a bit separate.
Yeah, I'm like, how are they going to bring him back? I really hope we get more of him, but I'm like, but what will be the excuse? So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, and I'm also interested, like, you know, the second episode essentially opens, or almost does, with this kind of beautiful shot of a man trudging through the wilderness and then shooting a pig, and we're like, who is this guy again? And then we realize that he's part of the police force and is brought back and maybe has some anger issues. So it'll be interesting to see, I don't know that actor's name, forgive me, but it'll be interesting to see how he kind of factors into things. You know, it seems like we are kind of amassing a pretty big cast of characters. Maybe that will shrink in later episodes, but I know we haven't even met one of the big ones, played by Cynthia Erivo. So yeah, I don't know. I like, but you know, if this becomes a sort of like team banding together to like, you know, fight something bad, I mean, that's very, very it, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mark Menchaca, is the name of the guy who plays the character you mentioned who's on the hunting trip, Jack Hoskins. I loved that introduction for some reason. I was like immediately like, who is this? I want to know more. And I guess that actor is on Ozark, though I don't remember him, from Ozark, but he really caught my attention. And this is an archetype that Stephen King loves to play with, which is someone in authority with anger issues. And so I, you know, this is exactly the kind of character that Stephen King loves, just like having you watch them explode. So that is like a ticking time bomb that I, you know, we should definitely all have our eye on. But speaking of that introduction, you know, we see him on this hunting trip, this beautiful overhead shot of, you know, the countryside or whatever. What do you think of Bateman's direction in these two episodes? I will start and say, you know, a famed critique of Ozark is that it is too physically dark, for people to see sometimes. And there are times during these two episodes when I like, especially there's a scene in the daughter's bedroom where we're supposed to like be registering like some sort of, wetness on the floor. And I had to like rewind multiple times and make sure all my blinds were closed to be able to make sure that I was seeing, noticing everything we were supposed to be noticing. So there were like some moments that felt like too physically dark for me on this episode. That being said, yeah. I do think it was like that quibble aside, I do think it was well done. Like, do you feel like you get a sense of who Bateman's style, as a director from these episodes compared to his other work?
Yeah. I mean, I think he's a good director. You know, he made a movie called The Family Fang, a number of years ago with Nicole Kidman. And I think he starred in it as well. And I think Christopher Walken maybe, that's based on a novel. That's actually a, kind of an interesting little, it's a quirky family indie. Yes. But like there's something else going on there. And obviously he's done well with Ozark, which is a kind of, you know, Breaking Bad-esque, you know, kind of lots of plots points clicking together kind of show, and that's stylish. But this, I think he had more, there was maybe a bit more, room for kind of artfulness, for atmosphere, for kind of slow build mood. And I think he kind of really seizes on that, you know. I think in conjunction with the score, which is really, you know, portentous and kind of looming, and the visuals of the show, something I like about the aesthetic is, even in the daytime, how you can just kind of feel this like clenching darkness, you know, and I don't mean like the literal darkness where you can't see, you know, key plot details, but just the sort of more, you know, abstract darkness. In nighttime scenes, you know, everyone seems to be kind of huddled in these little pools of light, you know, surrounded by this vast blackness. And I think that that's, you know, a sort of neat, visual motif, for a show that does seem to be about, malevolent forces, you know, kind of stalking people. So yeah, you know, good on Bateman. He's, you know, he's getting the insurance in for when he doesn't want to act. He can just make that leap full time.
We should note that, you know, so Richard Price wrote these, like first five episodes. Bateman directed the first two. But Karen Kusama, is going to be directing episode six. Karen Kusama is like a great talent, who I'm a big fan of. You know, she most recently directed Destroyer, the film starring Nicole Kidman, but, she's a very great moody director. And then, on the writing front, Dennis Lehane, you know, who wrote like Gone Baby Gone, among other things, Mystic River, wrote on a couple later episodes. So that's like an interesting vibe that we can look forward to, later on in the season. You know, that I think makes, I mean, like I'm completely fascinated what they will have eight more episodes to do. You know what I mean? Like you've seen more than I have, but I'm just sort of like, how are we already here? I mean, yes, Cynthia Erivo's not here yet, but like, how are we already here? And we've got eight more episodes to go. I'm utterly like, you know, at a loss and fascinated to see, what we could possibly fill eight more episodes with. But like Ben Mendelsohn is someone that I would, you know, just watch, I wouldn't even have listened to him read the phone book. He could read the phone book silently and I would watch his face do it. So, you know, it's like, yeah. I'm in for it. So we'll see what happens.
Well, what I like about the, I mean, in, you know, sort of in more hindsight, like the rushedness of the pilot episode is like, it does in a sense give you, you know, it gives you the impression like, oh, this story could be headed somewhere totally big and, you know, unexpected. And, you know, if we have eight more episodes left and the murder, you know, like the murder isn't by no means solved, but like, you know, we've cleared a suspect essentially, you know, I think it promises something kind of, you know, epic in a way. And I hope that the show lives up to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we get this, some hints of what could be happening, right? We've got a hooded figure. we've got someone mysterious whispering to a child at night. We've got wetness. I mean, that seems like to be a weird thing to say even once, if not twice in a podcast, but like, you know, there's this like puddle on the floor. And then also we find these clothes at the end that are, mm-hmm. that are wet. So that seems to be like a thing, to be looking out for. What other like hints or clues are we amassing about, what might be the actual threat, looming around this story?
Well, there was that, I love that line where Mendelsohn is talking to Bateman, like trying to figure out this thing with this van that was, you know, originated in New York, went, then ended up in Ohio and then somehow in Georgia. And he's like, and it's almost as if it followed you home.
Yes. Ooh,
you know,
creepy.
Which is such an ominous, cool, like visual even, like, and I, so like, that suggests something sort of supernatural. I mean, obviously the fact that like, you know, this is not just kind of anecdotal evidence within the show, like stories that like, oh, I know I saw Terry, you know, he was covered in blood or, you know, he was getting that kid's bike into the store. Like we see those things happen. So like in essence, they did happen as much as the, stuff at the, you know, academic conference happened. So like it doesn't really feel like it's a truth versus a lie or a delusion. It's a truth versus a truth. And sort of sorting through that, I think suggests something obviously supernatural or sci-fi or something.
Right. There's that security footage of, you know, cause like, you know, a big thing that clears Terry is that he's caught on tape at this like, you know, teacher's conference talking about banned books. And his fingerprints are on a book at that conference and stuff like that. But there's also this footage of him, in an alleyway, and like they're zooming in on the footage and Ralph's like, is he flipping us off? Like, is that what's happening? Like, what is happening here? So like, you know, what malevolent figure are we dealing with here, you know? So
yeah, and all the things were that he did to make sure he was seen, to make sure that the taxi cab driver called into her dispatcher, you know, like and you know, and Ralph lays this all out. He's like, who does this? Like, you know, and they're like, well, maybe he was feeling guilty and wanted to be caught, and they're like, nah, I don't buy that, you know. So like it sounded like Terry when he talked to Patty Considine in the strip club. It sounded like Terry or looked like him, you know, in the other instances. You know, there was something maybe a little off. So I don't know.
Yeah. I was rewatching that scene where he's talking to the little girl and he's got like the blood all over him. And the only thing that, you know, looks very different is not very different, but his hair is just like a lot more shaggy looking to me. I don't know. Cause there was a point when I'm, and maybe we still are, but there was a point early on before I had like sort of read the synopsis of the book. So I was like, is this a werewolf show? Is Jason Bateman playing a werewolf? Mm. So I mean, it might still be that. I don't want to rule anything out, but, I was like looking closely. It looks like extra shaggy in that scene. So, I don't know what's going on, but, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we know this is a Stephen King story, right? So we feel like mm-hmm. there must be something supernatural going on. So like, is it frustrating at all to watch, this detective do like shoe leather detective work when we know that there is likely to be some sort of supernatural answer to all of this? I say no, maybe if they had cast it differently, it would be a little more frustrating for me to watch. You know what I mean? But yeah. All right. Well, I mean, I don't know. Is there anything else we want to talk about in these first two episodes? We meet these characters. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm actually a little bit surprised that you didn't bring this up earlier. I mean, I think that something that's really, really crucial so far about this series is that not only do we have Ben Mendelsohn and Julianne Nicholson, but we also have Mayor Winningham saying Big Daddy's Hangry Barbecue. I mean, that's what show has done that? I mean, well, okay, Mayor Winningham says Big Daddy's Hangry Q.
Right.
And then Ben Mendelsohn and Julianne Nicholson say barbecue.
Right.
And I just think that's important to know. I mean, maybe that's an Easter egg. I don't know. But
yeah, and we also get that great shot of the pig. I mean, I know you're joking, but also like there's when we're like when our angry friend is interrupted on his hunting trip, he's trying to shoot a pig who's like very messily eating something. And I was like, ooh, that's one hungry big daddy over there. Are you saying that it is, that is hog season again on Still Watching?
I think it might be. And, you know, I think Big Daddy is the villain. On a serious note, like, actually, that is an interesting, I hadn't thought about that, but that is interesting in that, like, you have this guy hunting these wild pigs, which if you've ever, you know, laughed at that Feral Hogs tweet about the guns or whatever, 30 to 50.
Yeah.
There, I think Reply All, the podcast, did an episode where they interviewed the guy who tweeted that and then went into the whole wild hog problem or feral hog problem in the Southeast United States. And it's actually like a major problem. So anyway, that's a digression. But like, so he's killing a pig for sport. And then we have this barbecue restaurant where you're eating a pig for nourishment, pigs for the slaughter, that phrase. And it's like, so maybe who's ever doing this and took bites of this kid, is it nourishment, is it hunting, is it sport, like what, you know, what's going on here? And I think that, like, I like that sort of thematic you know thing with the
yeah, the last the I guess the last thing I'll say Supernatural wise is, like, it feels like you know, and sometimes Stephen King does this where it's just like an infection of evil, right? And so, like, this malevolent force that has come to town has not only taken this child, which is a tragedy, ruined Terry's life, right? But then maybe seems to be inspiring some other stuff, like possibly the brother, you know, pulling the gun at the courthouse, certainly seems to have inspired or at least is interested in this suicide attempt by the father, right? Like, that's an interesting thing, like that shot, right? Because we've got this suicide attempt and then pan down the street and we've got this figure there. And so, like, this idea of it's not enough to kill this child. This force is like a life ruiner as it spreads out, because it's like Terry is arrested in a way that, like, will forever haunt his family. And then the grief of this, you know, this boy's family is so cataclysmic that it is ruining their lives and causing their death. Did this malevolent force somehow prompt our detective figure to behave rashly? Like, what is the extent of this evil? What is the infection that we're dealing with here, in this town? And what is this guy who's discovered these wet clothes? Like, you know, what's going to happen next? Who knows? But like, that's the thing, is like, it's not just one murder. This force seems to be interested in causing mischief is too light of a word, but, you know, tragedy elsewhere. Mayhem.
And you know, and Yul Vasquez has that line when they're in the hospital, he's like, the whole family just gone like that or something, you know. And it's like, oh god, that's right, you know. I think that's kind of feels like where the mood of the show is taking us, that it's a more all-encompassing sort of thing. It's not just about this kid, although that's obviously the center of it, but there might be more. And the last thing I want to ask you is this the first time we've had someone give someone like a truly nuclear wedgie on a show that we've covered? Atomic wedgie, I guess, is the phrase.
I don't know. Did it happen in Westworld season 2 as well? I mean, you would think that a robot would be really good at giving a wedgie if they wanted to.
At some point, it must have.
Yeah, is that the technical definition of that kind of wedgie? Is it atomic?
it just seemed like really, really.
It went like midway up the back. It was pretty. It's pretty incredible. To answer your question, I do believe this is a first. We're still watching. I'm so glad that all of you are here for this momentous occasion as we roll into 2020. Richard, I'm so glad to have you back.
I don't think I've said the word wedgie since I was 15 years old.
I can't remember.
Thank you, The Outsider.
Yeah. fingers crossed for some swirlies to come or something like that. all right, Richard, until we talk about evil in this town next week, where can people find you?
I'm going to be at a book conference or a teacher conference talking about Fahrenheit 451 and the Iliad, because I'm real smart. Where will you be until next week?
Well, I will be handling, but not purchasing, a rare book at said conference, right down the hallway.
Getting our alibis all shored up.
Yeah, so you can find me there. You can find both of us on vanityfair.com. You can always hear us talk about award season stuff over on Little Gold Men, where it's like, we're in the thick of it now. We're in award season. So, tis the season to listen to us over there. You can, as I said, email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We would love to hear your thoughts on Atomic Wedgies, barbecue and otherwise. And, until next time, I was about to say like watch your underwear, but I just have decided not that that is not something I'm going to say. Until next time, you know, may all of your hunting trips come to fruition and may you never be called back to work.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR. From PR.